This is the NPR News Update for Monday, April 8th. News on your schedule. I'm Perry Hinnelly. The funding mechanism for the state share of a new Viking stadium continues to have problems. Locked out St. Paul Chamber Orchestra musicians have rejected management's latest contract offer. And the University of Minnesota is halting talks with potential donors that might have a conflict of interest in the possible merger between Minneapolis-based Fairview Health Services and Sanford Health. March was another bad month for the rollout of electronic pull-tab gambling in Minnesota, further calling into question the funding plan for the new Viking Stadium. Tim Nelson has more.
Data from the Minnesota Gambling Control Board shows that the games took in about $2.4 million in March, up from just under $2 million the month before. That's about double the growth reported in February. It's less than 3% of the more than $100 million in monthly sales the state projected about a year ago. But there were some troubling signs as well. The addition of new sites that offer the games actually slowed in March compared to February. Officials had hoped for 2,500 sites, but the state had less than 200. Suppliers added an average of less than one site per day again in March. Another key measure also fell. The state had figured the games would take in about $225 a day per machine when they were up and running, but 6 months after they started, those sales in March fell to an average of about $87 a day, an all-time low. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Locked out musicians of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra today announced they have rejected a management offer made Friday, raising the potential the rest of the season will be canceled. Management set a 5 p.m. deadline today for an agreement to prevent the cancellation, but musicians say Friday's offer does not alleviate their concerns. Musician negotiator Lynn Erickson says what they want is management to respond to a counterproposal they made on April 2nd. She says she's not sure what may happen today.
I would hope that we could come to an agreement by the end of the day. We really want to be back on the stage playing concerts, but it's up to management. They need to address our concerns and respond to our proposal.
Management rejected the musicians' proposal last week, saying it adds costs, which had not been agreed to during talks with St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman. Officials with Minneapolis-based Fairview Health Services and the University of Minnesota are scheduled to meet this week to talk about the U's plan to acquire the Minneapolis-based healthcare system. The U announced it was interested in acquiring Fairview at the same time merger talks between Fairview and rural healthcare giant Sanford Health emerged last week. At a Capitol hearing yesterday, representatives from the three organizations spoke before a standing-room-only crowd. Elizabeth Stawicki reports.
Minnesota's Attorney General has been wary of a potential merger between Sanford and Fairview for a number of reasons, but the major one is that Fairview is a nonprofit institution whose net worth of $1.2 billion in assets was created by Minnesotans through tax breaks, donations, and land for the benefit of Minnesotans. Fairview also operates the University of Minnesota's main teaching hospital, which has also had a long history of medical firsts. Sanford Health is duly based in North and South Dakota and has expanded its footprint to run clinics in 8 states. It's received $600 million in donations from T. Denny Sanford, a St. Paul native who made a fortune in the bank card industry. The Attorney General and the University of Minnesota worry that if Sanford Health takes over Fairview, it'll drain Minnesota assets to further the company's own expansion in other states. Gary Printup, a kidney transplant recipient at the hearing, said he owed his life to U of M transplant surgeon John Najarian. He said he came to show his opposition to any Sanford merger.
Now some guy that has deep pockets and likes to schmooze with the president of the university wants to come in here and take over the nonprofit that has saved so many people's lives. And I sure hope that you can stop the takeover of any part of the University of Minnesota Hospital.
Sanford Health sent 2 representatives to the meeting saying that its CEO was out of the country. Becky Nelson, Sanford's chief operating officer, read a statement from the CEO. She said the company is trying to standardize its systems, reduce costs, and hire and retain the best talent in a rapidly changing healthcare environment. Her testimony also shed some light on what the two sides have accomplished so far. She said Sanford's CEO determined that the combined organization could save between $40 million and $60 million a year, without cutting staff, but by sharing electronic medical record systems and saving on supplies. In addition, Sanford and Fairview had received in the last 30 days an analysis to see if there'd be any potential antitrust problems should they merge. Ann Nelson said Sanford and Fairview have been trading a so-called synergy book between the two organizations.
We approach everything that we do with a focus on the patient and what's best for the patient. So it's important that you have the conversation of what benefits the patient may experience as a result of this merger.
Meanwhile, the U of M appeared to distance itself a bit from Sanford. T. Denny Sanford is a donor to the U's athletic program and also an alum. The U has said it, too, is interested in making a bid to acquire Fairview. University of Minnesota General Counsel Mark Rotenberg said there would be a moratorium on all discussions of charitable gifts that could create any conflicts of interest.
That moratorium is intended to reassure you and everyone who cares about this that this rigorous and objective process will not be tainted in any way by conflicts of interest having to do with gifts for football or sports or anything else.
Fairview's interim CEO Chuck Moody finished out the hearing as time ran out, but didn't undergo the rigorous questioning the other representatives did. Moody said talks really are in the early stages, but in a highly competitive healthcare marketplace, the Sanford-Fairview partnership is worth looking at.
We think there's merit in us exploring it. We think that there's opportunity.
Attorney General Lori Swanson said the hearing only scratched the surface of the issues involved and that she hoped to have another hearing in 2 weeks. Elizabeth Stawicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The College of Visual Arts in St. Paul is set to close this June due to declining enrollment in a tough economy. But a group called CVA Action is trying to mount a rescue mission. Marianne Combs reports on what has become a pivotal week for the 90-year-old institution.
A recent gathering of about 100 College of Visual Arts alumni, faculty, and students took on the air of a 60s-style demonstration. Drummers, chanters, and sign holders occupied the lawn of the CVA Administrative Building on Summit Avenue. But it wasn't a protest. They were showing support for a plan to bring the school back from the brink of extinction. Considering the student body of CVA is only 170 students, it's a sizable turnout. Ben Levitz, CVA alum and president of the recently established group CVA Action, says a small and unrepresentative board decided to close the school.
It is unconscionable to us that a board of record low number made this decision. Traditionally, the school board has been in the 17-person range, and this board that made this decision was six people.
Levitz wants the CVA to more than double its board and to include alumni and faculty. His group then recommends the selling off of several college properties in order to increase the school's immediate cash reserves. He says CVA Action's plan will put the school back in the black inside of 3 years. Senior Tara Schaefer supports the plan. She says other larger art schools simply can't offer the same education as CVA.
The personal care provided by teachers is unimaginable. Every teacher I've ever had still knows me on a first name basis. Some of them call me or email me. And that amount of community is so rare anywhere, not in just college, but anywhere.
Schaefer says the current board needs to allow newcomers to join and make way for a new vision. To date, CVA Action has raised approximately $70,000 to put towards saving the college. But according to the board, the school needs somewhere between $3 and $5 million if it's to stay open. Chair Jim Rubenstein says it was only after several attempts to increase the school's enrollment and endowment that the board decided the College of Visual Arts was no longer a sustainable model in today's market.
We had had several years of financial struggling. For about 3 out of the last 5 years, we'd had to cut or postpone payments to some of our faculty and staff and make other serious budget cuts. We were running in the red.
In addition, the school enrollment dropped suddenly in the fall of 2012, just when the college was counting on an increase. The board decided its greatest responsibility was to find a way to close the school down in an orderly and dignified fashion, to complete the current school year, graduate seniors, give out full credits to underclass students, and still have enough funding left over to provide severance for faculty and staff, as well as scholarship help for students who transferred out.
And that was the reasoning behind what we did. We didn't want to come to a situation where we kept trying other things and kept running out of cash and have to close the doors, you know, in the middle of a semester.
Rubenstein says he's not surprised by the emotional response of many people connected to the school and the effort to keep it open. He, too, wishes it could stay open. But Rubenstein says the CVA action plan is optimistic, especially given that CVA has always had a hard time raising funds from its alumni.
We've had many alumni give in-kind contributions, which are helpful, but the real cash donations that help sustain and build an endowment and help break even have been very minimal.
CVA Action's Ben Levitz counters that for 90 years, the College of Visual Arts has managed to get by on a shoestring budget. He hopes the effort to save the school will galvanize enough support to keep it open for another 90. The College Board will meet Tuesday night to review the proposed action plan, but more importantly, it will vote on whether to allow new members to join just 3 months before the school is slated to close. Marianne Combs, Minnesota Public Radio News.
This is the NPR News Update, news on your schedule. Governor Mark Dayton today releases his preferred list of public works projects he wants funded this year. Dayton has said he will propose a bonding bill that borrows $750 million for infrastructure projects throughout Minnesota. Says he wants the money to help restore the state capitol, to build or improve civic centers in rural parts of the state, and to fix up the Minneapolis Veterans Home. House Democrats will release their own bonding proposal tomorrow. Republican House Minority Leader Kurt Dowd says he would prefer to see lawmakers focus on passing a two-year budget.
At an appropriate time, we're happy to talk about a bonding bill. I think the capital is something we do agree on. I don't know what other projects will be included, and we'll be eager to see what they put forth. But at this point, we don't think it's appropriate to talk about borrowing money before we know where we're going to spend our money in the next biennium.
Democrats will need several Republicans to vote for a public works bonding bill in order for it to become law. The Constitution specifies that bonding bills need the approval of 60% supermajorities to pass. Minnesota House DFLers are previewing their education bill by announcing an investment in early childhood scholarships. At a press conference at Washburn Elementary School in Bloomington yesterday, State Representative Ryan Winkler of Golden Valley said the scholarships will allow 3- and 4-year-old Minnesotans from poor families access to high-quality programs that will prepare them for kindergarten.
So finally, we have the stars aligned where we have a program that's ready to go, that is well designed and well thought through, that is matched by the political opportunity to finally put resources and funds behind it. That's what's so exciting about 2013.
Winkler says if DFLers don't succeed in getting something done in early learning by the end of the session, they should be held accountable. House Majority Leader Aaron Murphy of St. Paul said DFLers will pay for early childhood investments by raising some revenue and implementing reforms and reductions. The McKnight Foundation says it's focusing its climate-related efforts on the Midwest, beginning with a $25 million grant to two organizations. Rupa Shenoy reports.
McKnight says the Midwest has disproportionately high greenhouse gas emissions compared to the rest of the country. But Foundation President Kate Wolford says the region's economy, culture, industry, and academic resources should make it a leader in the transition to a clean energy economy.
We also think that the communities are demanding it. Communities are seeing these changing weather patterns and worried about how many floods of the centuries that we're seeing and drought and what this will mean for agriculture. So we think that there's demand across communities, government, and business to really position us for leadership in this arena.
The grantees are the Energy Foundation and REAMP, a collaboration of 150 organizations across 8 states, including Minnesota, that work together to increase energy efficiency and reliance on renewable resources. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
At a debate yesterday, the candidates for mayor of Minneapolis clashed over how the city should respond to complaints against the police department. Last year, Minneapolis introduced a new system that includes both civilians and police internal affairs officers in such investigations. Don Samuels, who championed the changes as a city council member, says they have improved the system.
Instead of making decisions as civilians and sending it to the police department to make decisions about discipline, let them sit together and talk it out so that the incompatibilities get thrashed out at the table. The other thing was not working, and the community was frustrated.
Cam Winton said the new system should be given a chance to work, but former council member Jackie Cherry Holmes and former Hennepin County Commissioner Mark Andrew argued the police should not be expected to investigate themselves. Candidates Betsy Hodges and Gary Schiff both voted against the changes as council members. The city of Minneapolis tomorrow will share some of its latest efforts to diversify its pipeline of government workers. Lori Ewan reports.
At the heart of the efforts is a desire to narrow a stubborn unemployment gap between whites and residents of color. Twin Cities African Americans, for example, are three times as likely as whites to be unemployed. Last year, the city started a summer internship program for college students of diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds called Urban Scholars. Karen Francois is the city's director of employment equity and says it only makes sense to help develop young leaders for the public sector.
Also, we've got a silver tsunami coming up where in 2016, about 20% of our workforce will be in a position to retire.
Francois says the internship program, which has since doubled in size, will prepare young workers to fill a void left by retiring baby boomers. The city is presenting its findings to business leaders and other partners at the Minneapolis Convention Center. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And finally, is there anything on your Facebook page that could keep you from getting a job? In today's sluggish economy, job candidates might be nervous about potential employers checking them out online in places like Facebook or Twitter. But as Annie Baxter reports, the information on social networking sites makes some employers nervous too.
If employers really wanted to, they could probably learn your political views, how fat or skinny you are, not to mention your race, marital status, and whether you have a mother with cancer whose care might distract you from work. If you don't set strict privacy settings on your various social media accounts, potential employers can peer right into your private life. But some companies avert their eyes.
People could post on somebody's wall, "Hey, you were really wild at the party last night. It was great." I feel pretty clear as a recruiter, I do not want to know.
That's Sue Melrose. She's the senior recruiter at Thrivent Financial for Lutherans in Minneapolis. Melrose says she and her colleagues avoid researching a potential worker on social networking sites. LinkedIn feels okay to them since it's largely used for professional purposes. But beyond that, Melrose and her colleagues rely on applicants' resumes and their performance in interviews, not on their Facebook pages.
And it's really about, I think, the ethical, the fair thing. You look solely at their skills and experience and ability to do the job.
Legally, that's a safe way to play it. Probing deeper into someone's online existence can cause trouble, according to Teresa Thompson. She's an employment lawyer with Fredrickson and Byron in Minneapolis.
You're going to get information that maybe as an employer you shouldn't be looking at when making hiring decisions.
For example, maybe you'd learn that an applicant is pregnant. A couple years ago, Thompson was addressing a group of employers about the perils of Googling a candidate. She was pregnant herself at the time.
And I stood out from behind the podium and turned sideways, which was frightening, and showed my stomach to the world. And I said, "So, if you had to choose between me at 9 months pregnant and an equally qualified person, who would you choose?" And everybody in the room hung their head and looked down.
Now, it might be hard for a pregnant candidate who is not hired to prove discrimination. But if someone sued, Thompson says an employer would have to admit to Googling the candidate they spurned.
And then the question would come out. Then is that the reason?
Thompson is unaware of any lawsuits alleging that a company's use of social media did harm a job applicant. But companies are taking action to avoid getting slapped with a suit. Some hire an outside vendor to conduct the social media research for them, or they delegate the research to an employee who's not part of the hiring process. Those third parties would then delete any legally sensitive information like race or age from their reports about the candidates. But Jason Averbrook thinks this is an overly legalistic way to do business. His company, Aperio, advises businesses on talent management. Averbrook says recruiters and hiring managers need to worry about finding the talent they need and not obsess over the problems that could come up during a social media search.
There's a lot of coulds. The question is do I focus on those coulds and not do it? Or do I focus on the things that are truly going to get me the best people and then deal with the coulds as an exception?
Averbrook says employers in sectors like information technology cannot wall themselves off from social media. The workers they need are not seeking new jobs. So the companies must rely on social media to identify high-talent workers that they can then poach from other companies. Even Sue Melrose, the cautious recruiter at Thrivent, gets that. She says if it gets harder to find the right people to fill open positions at Thrivent, her strategies may need to shift.
And that may change how we need to think about our sourcing and have social media just be a much more integral part of what we do.
Until then, Melrose is holding to the principles she values herself. Job candidates' private lives are just that, private. Annie Baxter, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And that's the NPR News Update for Monday, April 8th. I'm Perry Vanelli. Thanks for listening.